Heads up, Basic Brewing Radio listeners, the American Homebrewers Association has a special deal just for you. Join the AHA or renew your membership in the month of August, and you'll receive a free copy of Designing Great Beers by Ray Daniels. Just head over to homebrewersassociation.org, click Join, and use the offer code BBR at checkout. With Zymergy Magazine money-saving member deals and access to exclusive events, including the National Homebrew Competition, the AHA is an indispensable resource for new and veteran homebrewers alike. Visit homebrewersassociation.org, use code BBR, and claim your free book today. Hurry! Offer ends August 31st. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 27th, 2015. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about homebrewing. This week, homebrewers Nick and Kurt Keast share their barrel progression experiment. The father-son homebrewing team has been brewing a succession of beers to go into an 8-gallon whiskey barrel. We'll sample the beers and check how the oak character changes over time. If you're new to homebrewing or would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on the Google Plus as well. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first and go to basicbrewing.com. Click on our associate link there on the right-hand side of the page. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly, greatly appreciate your support. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes or Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app as well. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support, and thanks to everybody who's done so already. We have less time this week before our interview since we talked for a good long time, but I do want to mention something extremely exciting that happened to me last week. This past Friday, I went down to Apple Blossom Brewing Company in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and they brewed a 10-barrel batch of my cream ale recipe. Very cool. Marcus Ward and Roger Raines work there very well together in the Apple Blossom Brew House and made the brew day look extremely easy. And I recorded some audio and video, so look for that in a future episode. And check out our page on facebook.com/basicbrewing. And I posted some pictures there as well. And I posted a picture that made me look like I actually did some work. But I'm really looking forward to tasting that beer at Apple Blossom. And Marcus says that he wants to try to put the beer on nitro as well. So I'm really excited about that. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. If you'll remember a few weeks back, I had a question from Joe on a diacetyl rest for his Munich-style lager brew. After I read his email on the show, Joe wrote this. He says, "Thanks for featuring my question on your show. Now I really wish I had included where I'm from in my first email because nobody will believe that question was from me otherwise." Well, so credit for that question goes to Joe in Gainesville, Florida. The answer is Joe in Gainesville, Florida. So I hope that helps, Joe. This from Sean in Kansas on the topic of brewing with bread yeast. Sean says, "I've been making mead for many a year now and used bread yeast in many meads after I moved to Kansas. Not knowing where the closest craft beer store was at the time, I figured what the harm in using bread yeast? My mead would start out extra foamy and end up a little extra bitter. Since I was new to mead at the time, I figured that was the way it was supposed to be, till I read an SCA, Society for Creative Anachronism, article on brewing mead. It said, never use bread yeast for two reasons. Number one, the brewing process starts out extra foamy. And number two, it makes the mead extra bitter. Who knew? With that, I found some homebrew supply stores and started to use wine yeast, and my mead became better. I listened to your podcast on using beer yeast to improve meads even more. Another visit to my local homebrew supply store, and now my mead has improved 100-fold. I haven't looked back. So he's been using beer yeast and wine yeast instead of the bread yeast. So that's from the other side of the topic of making mead with bread yeast. So I appreciate the note, Sean. I'd be interested to hear from anybody else. I can only say from that one experience there from that tasting, but it didn't seem to be foamy. Of course, I don't know about the brewing process that Tim went through, but and I didn't get a bitterness from that. Maybe because it started off so high, the gravity started off so high in the beginning that it was plenty sweet to cover up any bitterness in the end. But anyway, so that's a note to put in your some data to put in the equation about bread yeast. I appreciate that from Sean. Here's one from Brew in a Bag from Greg. Greg says, I'm wondering if you can explain something regarding brew in a bag. When using this technique, you often mention that you hold your mash at a particular temperature similar to using a mash tun. I've always found it difficult doing a brew in a bag on an electric stovetop because my temps don't stay constant. After I raise my mash in a bag to an appropriate mash temp, should I leave the element on or be turning it off? I find if I leave it on, the temp continues to increase. Makes sense. Turn it off and it drops below mash temp, and I can't seem to find a good in-between temp. What's your approach? Well, if you've been listening to the show lately, you'll know that my approach to maintaining brew in a bag mash temps has changed recently, and I'll get into that a little bit. But before I talk about that, I did do a few things to maintain the mash temp in the kettle before my recent change. I wouldn't leave the heating element on throughout the whole process, throughout the whole mash. That's an easy question. Now, what would I do to maintain mash temperatures in the kettle? To tell you the truth, on 5-gallon batches, I would just wrap the kettle in blankets and towels to try to maintain the mash temperature and hope that was sufficient. And I would still lose some mash temperature, but, you know, I'd brewed good beer. You can apply some heat to the kettle to bring the mash temperature back up if you need to, but you want to make sure that the bag is lifted off the bottom of the kettle. And if you're using a keg, you want to keep it off the bottom of that to avoid melting and scorching of the bag. And you've got to kind of stir up the fluid in the grain too to make sure it heats up evenly. Some brewers use an overturned metal colander in the bottom of the kettle to keep the bag off the bottom, to keep it from scorching. Or if I'm mashing a small batch in a small kettle, I will preheat my oven to 150 degrees Fahrenheit and keep the kettle in the oven during the mash if it'll fit. And that works really well for small batches. So there are some suggestions for traditional brew in a bag. But as I said, my technique has changed recently since I got my electric brew in a bag system from Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa, our sponsors, ongoing sponsors for the show. My High Gravity system uses an electric heating element in the kettle, a recirculating pump, and a very cool electronic controller to keep mash temperatures rock solid. You can see that at youtube.com/highgravitybrew. And I don't have to worry about blankets or towels anymore. And if I want to ramp up the mash temperature to do a step mash or to do a mash out, all I have to do is push a button and maybe dial up a control on the side of the controller. It's very easy to do. High Gravity's brew in a bag systems come in 3 different versions: a 240-volt 10-gallon system with a pump, 120-volt 5-gallon system with a pump, and a 120-volt 5-gallon system with no pump if you want to go old school. You can check all that out at highgravitybrew.com. And while you're there, you can get $7.99 flat rate shipping on ingredients and many other products. And be sure to thank them when you place your order for their continuing support of this podcast. They're great folks. Highgravitybrew.com. Okay, this is the next-to-last episode from our trip to San Diego and the National Homebrewers Conference. There's a lot of really good information in here if you're thinking about using one of those smaller oak barrels that you've heard Andy and me talk about on the show, or just in using oak barrels in general. But aside from the information and good beers, it was great to spend time with Nick and Kurt Keast and to see that they are using homebrewing as a way to stay closer as father and son as they have moved farther away geographically. Nick Keast, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me. I have some beers I want to share with you guys because you've been a great inspiration and it's a fun set of experiments here.
And you have somebody with you who got you started, literally.
Yes. Yeah, so I have my dad, Kurt Keast, here, and he's been my great assistant brewer, helps me out on brew days, and has really helped do a lot of cool stuff. And then we were in Pacifica, California, but now I've moved to Seattle, but he's still been taking care of the barrel that these came from. So I actually remotely am like, hey, can you do this? Can you do that to help out? And he's been wonderful.
Welcome, Kurt.
Well, thanks for having us. It's great to be the keeper of the barrel and also to help finance this operation.
And we also have Steve Wilkes.
Hey, James.
And we're going to now tell us what we're going to do today.
I bought, after seeing an ad, I think in AJ, bought one of those 8-gallon rye whiskey barrels from Woodinville Whiskey up in Woodinville, Washington. And so actually my dad ordered it. And it was on its way. We're like, okay, we got to do something about this. So I kind of came up with an idea of a progression of beers that would use the rye character up front, and then later we'd get less and less of the rye, more and more barrel, and then eventually let's make it sour. So this is a progression of beers that went through that barrel.
How many beers are we going to be tasting?
Four and a variant. So five.
All right, now what do we start with first?
Okay, this one was the first one. I call it a Riley wine. Think barley wine, but with a bunch of rye in it. Because since it's a rye barrel, whiskey barrel, I thought it would only be appropriate. The only issue here is it started at least 12% ABV before it went in the barrel, and there was a lot of spirits in the barrel. So this is probably at least 14%, and when I went dry bottle condition it, the yeast just said, nope. So then I went and popped it open, put in some new carb tabs, some new yeast, nope. So it is toxic to yeast, and so this is flat but interesting. A little taste. It's like a really good beer schnapps.
Very interesting. All right. Now I'm thinking.
So I need a pint of this, right?
Is that, yeah. And these are the first beers of our day, so yeah. It's, might as well start big.
That's right.
Now while you're pouring, I'm going to make some assumptions. So go ahead and pour.
Okay.
First, I'm going to blow my nose. Okay. I'm going to make some assumptions. When we think barley wine, we think of a full-bodied beer.
Yes.
And when we think of lots of rye, we also think of big in body. So
yes.
I'm going to predict that this, even though it has the whiskey, that it will be pretty chewy. What do you think?
I think it'll be very chewy. And I think it'll be very hoppy. I don't know. But I think it'll have a lot of hops.
Inspired by West Coast barley wines like Bigfoot. So, yeah, there's a good charge of hops. But at this point, this is probably 4 years old. So okay. It's mellowed that. Because this is the very start of the experiment.
Okay. And we're expecting a lot of wood because this is the first one in it. A lot of whiskey and a lot of wood. And here we go.
That's really good. I like this quite a lot. There's some good oxidation in there. It's got that raisiny, you know, it's been in the barrel a while, the bottle a while, but man, that's good stuff.
Wow.
Sweet, potent, knock you on your... What's your last name, Keister? It'll knock you on your Keister pretty quick.
You should call this the Keister. Yeah, boy. You get the hard alcohol, so you get the whiskey, you get the wood... and it's not as sharp and aggressive on the wood side. I guess it's probably because it's 4 years old.
Yeah. And it was only a few weeks in there. So it was in the barrel, because I knew it was going to be really aggressive up front. So I think it was maybe about 4 weeks in the barrel, maybe five, just enough for me to get the next beer ready to go in.
So I like it quite a bit. It's the wood has mellowed probably over time. You get a lot of
the oaky, vanilla-y things going on?
Yeah, I like to get a lot of Milli Vanilli. But
I swear it's his first beer. But yeah, also,
a lot of vanilla.
Also, I get a bit of brown sugar flavors.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, it's just that wintery, caramelly kind of beer.
And if I remember the recipe correctly, there were no sugar additions. This was an all-malt beer. It was most epic, messy brew day ever because 8-gallon barrel, and I knew I'd need electricity, 10 gallons of this so strong stuff. I think I actually did it kind of party guile, did the second runnings into a small beer so I could keep the gravity up.
And you know, I don't care that it's not carbonated.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is like drinking a port for me.
I was going to say the same thing. I don't miss the carbonation at all. This is something like doesn't have the gravity of a Utopius, but, you know, something that it doesn't hurt it not to be carbonated.
I also kind of want to put it over, like, vanilla ice cream.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now make a vanilla ice joke.
I can. No, you've already done that for me. But this would be great to soak a fruitcake in.
Oh, yeah. Very nice.
Yeah.
Yes. Kurt, your feedback.
Well, I'm really proud of Nick for coming up with this combination, but it was interesting. We did take a bunch of the bottles that were flat and carbonated them,
Cornelius.
Cornelius, and actually, it makes it. It is a different product then, and it really actually is very tasty. So, both versions are very tasty. But I, you know, this is kind of Madeira, kind of a quality to it, and I actually taste a little bit of the flinty of the, you know, the Madeirized.
So, what did the carbonation bring to the beer?
Well, I think at this level, you want about 2 ounces max. So, a 12-ounce bottle you share around a bunch of people. Yeah. With carbonation, I could drink 6 ounces. It really increased the drinkability, maybe even more, maybe 8. It lightened up the body, so it's not as syrupy in mouthfeel. And the acidity counterbalances the sweetness a little of the CO2. So I do feel it made it more drinkable, but less like a port or a Madeira sort of effect.
So it's probably, for safety's sake, it's probably good it's flat.
Yes.
It'd be good to have this in a Grolsch bottle so that you could reseal it. It would get some oxidation, but oh, and that's another thing. It doesn't taste really oxidized to me. This doesn't taste like a 4-year-old beer.
Yeah, I mean with this epic gravity, I think that really does help. There are some dark malts that help, but it's pretty light. Most of the color is actually coming from the rye and the sheer amount of grain and boiling. But in the barrel, I mean, it should have oxidized in the barrel, but it worked quite well just in that time. It does soften it really fast in the barrel. It's really quick. I was taking samples every week or so, and I'm like, oh, this is getting there really quick.
Very interesting. Can you rinse me a little there, Steve?
Well, okay.
And tell us about the next. Are we ready to talk about the next beer? Oh, that was really good. And we've got a lot left.
How about I just give you a glass?
All right. Yeah. Okay. All right. The next
glass
beer.
Of water, however, might be a great idea.
Well, yeah.
That's easy.
A little housekeeping here.
Let's grab that plate because there's 90% odds. No, maybe 100% odds. This is going to foam over.
Oh. So what is this going to be?
So this is an Imperial Russian Stout, and it's around maybe 11%, based on a recipe from Brewing Classic Styles. I forget the title of it, but it's a really aggressive one, where Jamil said to age it for at least a year. Now, at this point, it's a lot longer, but what I found fascinating is when I took a sample out of the barrel after 4 weeks, it was already smoothed off the edges. That a year in a bottle, or maybe about 4 weeks in a barrel. This has more black malt than I've ever used in anything. This was black as night. I think there's equivalent of 4 pounds of black malt per 5 gallons. This is about 8 pounds of very dark black malts in this batch.
Yeah. Andy Sparks has joined us. Why don't you come around the end of the table here, Andy, so we can reach you. We should pour Andy a little bit of this one first. This is a big old barley wine that, and you got one of the eight-gallon barrels, 8-gallon wooden barrels, the whiskey barrels, right?
Oh, right, for the Woodinville Whiskey Company,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. Same company.
Right?
Yeah. So this is Nick and Kurt.
Hey, Nick. Hey, Kurt. Great to see you guys.
And this experiment is aging, using the barrel in these different styles and then aging for different times. This was the first beer in the barrel, and... Take a swig and see what you
well,
think.
Well, I've smelled it, and it smells delicious, and it reminds me of something. Hold on. Wow, that's really, really delicious. Lots of that kind of vanilla and some raisin stuff going on. It reminds me a little bit of the beer we made.
Yeah,
now that you say, that was an oatmeal stout, a giant oatmeal stout, right?
A gigantic oatmeal stout.
Yeah.
And it was very nice.
Did you end up with one of the bourbon barrels from Woodinville?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is one of the rye whiskey barrels from them.
Cool.
So same barrel, different stuff in it.
All right.
And I actually went and visited them and brought two bottles of some of the stuff I'd made to them and gave it to them. And they were really honored to be like, oh, this is really cool that you did this with our barrel.
Very cool.
Yeah, I imagine. Okay, the next one.
Okay, so Imperial Russian Stout. Very big, but not quite as big. And at this point, the whiskey character of the barrel's gone down a bit. Amazingly dark, but it really smoothed out as it aged. So, and this one really seems to like to gush, so I'm going to open it and then get ready to pour right away.
Well, it'll... And I'm sure we'll gush about the beer, so... No, it's not bad. It's not gushing. It's good.
Amazing black
Woo!
Head.
Man.
Yeah.
None more black.
Right? It's a bit like a Guinness, the way it is almost all foam once you pour it in the glass, but it looks like it's going to settle out nicely.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, that smells. That smells delicious. I'm not... I guess I'm not smelling as much of the wood as in the first one.
I'm not getting any little green apple.
That's an inside joke from way back.
Way back.
It's got great head retention.
Yeah, the head is almost mousse-like, the way it's kind of soft and fluffy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's settling out, and you can see it's inky black. And I haven't gotten down and sipped any yet. Hold on.
That's delicious.
Wow. Mm. Imperial Russian Stout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really, really nice.
In comparison to the first one, the body is quite a bit lighter.
Yeah.
It would have been interesting to go from, say, like a regular Pilsner or something to this. I'm sure that this would have felt a lot heavier in that regard. But going from that first one, which was like a milkshake, to this one, this the mouthfeel is like a lighter beer.
Well, the first one had a good chunk of rye, maybe 30%, and so that amplified it even more than the gravity did. This one doesn't have rye, although I do believe it may have had some oats, which is why we're getting such awesome head retention.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, that's nice. It's, but I still get some of the whiskey in there. I mean, it's still, it is more subtle, but again, if this were the first one, I would have said, woo, that's a lot of whiskey. I'm not getting as much oak character, I don't think, yep. as in the first one.
Yeah, the vanilla and stuff is much more subdued in this.
Yeah,
you can tell that it doesn't take, much to get the wood out, so to speak.
I'm not going there.
it pretty quickly. I think this had more oak, and this is now almost 4 years old.
Yeah.
It did have more oak then, but it never had as much as the first one did.
So I have a question about rye barrels in general. Are they charred like a bourbon barrel?
Yeah, these barrels are identical to the ones they're using, I believe, same char level. These barrels are actually really fascinating. Andy, have you taken like a flashlight in there and peered in there?
Yeah, with a little honeycomb. They drill little holes in the staves so that it adds additional surface area to kind of create the effect of an even bigger barrel.
They also put in some additional staves inside, so there's crisscrossing staves. inside.
And then those have holes.
And those also have holes.
So not only does an 8-gallon barrel have a surface-to-volume ratio that's a significant amount more than a 55 or 30, but they've probably doubled it again with all their tricks on the inside, which can help accelerate whiskey, but some people argue it can be too much, that you need some time. And similarly for beer, I was worried about how much exposure it would have. So that's why, like, the instant I'd... This is using up all my fermentation gear, because I was pre-fermenting these before they went in the barrel, just giving... I wasn't fermenting in the barrel. I was kind of secondarying them. So I'm using up all my fermentation gear to get ready for the next one. So the instant would go in, then the next day I'd brew the next beer that would be ready. So at the time it takes the first one to ferment, I'd then get the next one out and swap. So I didn't keep it in there for much more than 6 weeks until we get to the last beer.
And so remind me again how long this one stayed in the barrel.
Well, this all happened a while ago, so it's all a bit fuzzy. but I'd say this is no more than 6 weeks. I was amazed at how, when I tasted the beer right out of the fermenter, this was so aggressively bitter and black. And then as I was tasting, I put a little hole with a nail at the bottom of the barrel, based on advice, I think it was from Vinny, a stainless nail. And I was just taking a taste every few days. I'm like, whoa, this is mellowing immensely. So I'm like, okay, let's get it out of there.
It's really good.
The only comment I was saying, you were noticing, we're tasting them in reverse order. If you had this just by itself, this is a very big IRS that is very, you know, tasty and rich. And although the oak flavor is less than the right. first one, it's still got a lot of oak and vanilla. And I think by itself, this is a really super, it's like a great dessert IRS stout. And you guys all know about, you know, ice cream in stout. And this makes the best, you know, stout float.
Awesome. So what's up next?
So this is my 4.1 in terms of the numbers. This is a variant of the same beer. So I actually took, since I had 10 gallons of beer in an 8-gallon barrel, I poured off 2 gallons about a week from the end into 2 1-gallon growlers, put the other 2 gallons that hadn't been in the barrel in, and then took those 1-gallon growlers and stuffed in this one, actually inspired by some of Steve's video stuff, mole stuff. So there are chipotle and cocoa powder in here.
I'm excited.
Yeah, I go crazy for cocoa powder.
He's got 100 of them.
It's a quick pour.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere.
So I think the cocoa powder maybe changes a little bit how the head works. So it ends up foaming over more often, and the head dies down quicker.
Yeah, it's although it's sticking around pretty good.
Yeah, and it's again very very moussey, real thick, very very dark brown. I guess. Oh, interesting! Very interesting.
Oh yeah. There's a lot going on in there.
Oh man. The chili's really come through. I mean, I haven't tasted it yet. Mm.
The chilies on the aroma are pretty intense.
Yeah, I'm philosophically about chilies that I love the flavor of them. So I don't like hot chilies. I don't see a point of ghost peppers or even habaneros because I'd rather have more chili than less that's hot. So I really like going with poblanos, chipotle, ancho, things like that, just so I can get more chili in there. So I think this is like, you know those plastic bags that you get at the supermarket with the chilies in them? This is, I think, about half of one of those bags just for the 1 gallon.
Oh,
yeah.
Did you?
It's either ancho or I think it's chipotle.
Now, did you de-seed them? Or since they were dry, I guess it's harder to de-seed. No,
smashed them up a bit so I can get them in the neck, but there were seeds and all.
Well, there's some heat, but it's not aggressive.
No, not at all. Very nice.
Somebody else talk. I want to drink.
Well, I think the fun thing is, and this is the whole homebrew idea, is the experimentation, and we're just sitting there in the garage. What are we going to do next? How do we jam that in? And, you know, it's completely on the cuff. It's not a pre-planned exercise. If it was the 10th batch, you'd have a technique, but you know, these are all one-offs, and it's fun when it works.
And you've only got a gallon to risk.
Yep,
so,
yeah.
And again, this beer is 4 years old?
I mean, similar age span, so yeah, around 4 years old.
But it's held on to a lot of the character. Was the character of the peppers more aggressive in the beginning? Has it mellowed out over time?
I wouldn't say it was much hotter, but I think it was a bit sharper. I think it's mellowed the front of the tongue element, but I'd say the kind of lingering little light heat on the tongue is pretty similar to what I remember.
I'm not sure I get a lot of, like, a chocolate flavor. Do you, I mean, other than, I mean, it's not, well, is this the previous one? Or
I think this is the previous one. Chocolate.
Really?
I get some cocoa on the nose, along with the peppers. And kind of very earthy. When you taste it, the peppers are very earthy and rich.
We have the luxury of...
Yeah, and for me, this is about the perfect level of spiciness. We've tried several spiced pepper beers here. And for me, this doesn't give me that kind of the back of my throat is burning kind of thing, where some of them have. This is still just a mild, very, very subtle heat.
Yeah. Okay, I'm wrong. I did a side-by-side. This is that memory element that we were talking earlier. So yeah, it's less carbonated than the first one in this case, and yeah, it's more chocolatey. Cool.
Unfortunately, I'm out of. I think we just had one bottle with us, and we shared it with some great folks last night. But I also did a coffee version, where I put it on in the other 1 gallon fermenter, like a good 4 ounces maybe of whole beans. And left it on there for a few weeks of Major Dickinson blend, which is my dad's favorite blend of coffee.
Yeah. Now, Steve, you're saying that chipotle is
smoked
peppers.
And usually in a mole sauce, so it couldn't have been crushed up.
By crushed, I literally mean it was a smoked pepper that I like just had to mangle so I could get
was
it in there.
Was it in a can or in a...
No, this was the dry plastic one. So I'm trying to remember if it was...
That would be a Maria. If it's a smoked jalapeno not in mole sauce is a Maria.
Oh, yeah.
So there is a difference, and it would, to you know, just to be clear to the listeners, because you buy a can of chipotle peppers... Which
are
is
delicious if you just blend those up in a food processor as a sauce. Oh, so tasty. But yeah, so that there's the complex. If you do it this way, it's that thing. This way, that thing. And yeah, this was a while ago. I don't quite exactly remember. Yeah. But they were definitely a dry pepper with a bit of smoke.
Okay.
Yeah, so
actually, it's Marita. So pepper experts, we appreciate your...
forbearance.
you can delete that email that you're writing up now.
Yeah.
But thanks, Steve, for catching that. Okay, so the coffee one, how did you put the coffee in the beer?
Just in that same, so one of those big 1 gallon growler sort of things, just put about 4 ounces of whole beans in it and let it rest for a few weeks before I bottled.
There you go. And then the next beer.
Now what are we doing?
Whee!
I'm getting happier all the time.
Yeah. So it'll be time for a nap.
So this is where normally you're very lucky you get to taste great beers. I wouldn't say this is a bad beer, but it wasn't a home run. But we have a way to fix that. Also kind of less from you guys, blend beers. I start as a table blend.
Will I get to second base? As long as I get to second base, I'm okay.
So this was a Belgian triple that I put into the barrel. And the problem is, even as much before we said, oh, the oak's dying down, at this point, it's still pilled out too much tannins, in my opinion. So it's a bit aggressive in that regard. But when we blend it with basically the same recipe, but without the oak, I think you can get a really nice blend between the two and tone it down. So we'll pull that one out, too, and you can, I think, blend to taste.
Cool. So. And that one's in a Grolsch bottle.
Yeah, this is... Oh, we needed so many bottles to do this. I was asking friends, do you have bottles? I had, like, trash cans full of these things soaking. Because this is happening... This is intense. This is every 4 to 6 weeks, I'm having to bottle 8 gallons of beer. Normally, I keg, and I don't go through that much beer. So this is, I think, what a batch of, like, this is about 70 bottles I needed per. So we tried to do 22s. We did a few, you know, the really big stone 5-liter giant bottles. We did that. And so we've opened those for some parties, stuff like that. So.
So we're expecting this to be bad.
Well, no.
Or over-oaked.
It has flaws.
But that just means it's Amish.
Over-oaked?
Well, no. The Amish, when they make a quilt, they always make one stitch bad because only God can make something that's perfect.
Oh. Well, there you go.
So you learn something new every day when
that's,
you're
that's
around
the thing,
me.
That's the thing I learned today?
That's what you learned today.
I think it's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, that's actually, why you poured in reverse order.
Also, age has helped. When I had this even a year ago, the tannins were more aggressive.
Yeah, and of course, I haven't tasted it yet. I'm just smelling it, and you certainly don't perceive the tannins in the aroma. It smells very good, and it, I think maybe even smells more like it's been barreled than maybe the last one, almost because... Maybe there isn't so many other aromatics going on from all the coffee and the peppers and all that stuff.
It doesn't have a lot of competition.
The cocoa, not the coffee.
I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, me too. I don't find anything to complain about.
And this has been in the bottle for a while, right?
Yep.
Okay, so one of the things we know about winemaking is that tannins do tend to kind of settle out and kind of mellow over time, and so this may be exactly what's happened to this. Like a fine wine, it's just improved.
In regards to settling, I'm actually impressed how clear it is. These did get driven down here from Northern California just a few days ago, and was wandering around in my bag while I was at two earlier seminars.
Yeah.
These actually have all been pretty good, and I was worried about kind of yeast or things like that. They've all been pretty good in that respect. I just find... that as I get it kind of the middle of my tongue, particularly as you have more, and we're not going to have too much today, you just get a bit of astringency on the middle of your tongue. It's not horrible, but it's definitely, and that element was more profound before.
Yeah, I would say we haven't tasted this for probably a year, and I go up with your idea that how much time really can help a wine, and in this case, a beer, and so don't give up, you know.
I tend to believe that on all the beers. Every beer that I've made that I ever bothered to put in a bottle is still sitting in a bottle somewhere, not giving up on them.
In the library.
And the great part, my dad has a big dirt crawl space that's in Pacifica, so that's kind of a constant 60 year-round, never gets warm, never gets cold, and then it's dirt, so it's even better. So it's about a 55 perfect cellar.
Yeah.
And so there's just, we got a whole bunch of IKEA wooden wine racks, and they're full with a bunch of aging homebrew and commercial beers that we've been aging. So these have been in good conditions since the beginning.
Excellent. Yeah, it tastes like it's well cared for. Again, I'm not getting like cardboard, you know, sherry or oxidized stuff going on. I think it's tasty. I think it'd be good with food.
And has it always been in this Grosch bottle?
Yeah.
Wow. Tremendous.
Okay, so this is, I believe, so I made a pretty large batch for this one, maybe about 12 gallons, and about 4 of it never went into the barrel. And so we bottled that right up. And so this is the same recipe, same time span, no barrel.
Oh.
So it's a good reference point.
Side by side.
We got plenty in the first, too.
Sorry, Amy.
The fun part, even about a year ago, I felt that the oaked was a little too aggressive. And so I brewed up the same recipe again. Made a 2.5-gallon batch. And then in my 5-gallon keg, I had a bunch of these bottles, and I started pouring them in and tasting it. And after I got just about a gallon and a half, it was great. And so then I had a keg of about 4 gallons of this blend. And it's also, I think, maybe brings a bit of youthfulness by having the younger beer and the older beer together.
My first impression, I got a little teeny hint of butteriness that I didn't get on the barrel aged one. I don't know if you guys are getting that, and I don't know if that's what to contribute that to. As I taste it, it doesn't taste like a diacetyl bomb, you know, but it's kind of more rounder in that regard than the oak aged version.
Right. Actually, I think I find the oak aged version to kind of be smoother and, to me, more pleasing. If I had to drink the two of them, I actually prefer the barrel aged version.
Yeah, I do too.
It's fun. I'm looking at the two of them. I've got the same amount in my glass, and the color difference is fun. Because it's the same beer, and this is what the barrel contributed, and it's from a very blonde beer to a reddish hue in the oak aged.
Yeah, I gotta say, I mean, you talked the barrel version down, but I prefer. I mean, and this beer that without the wood is not a bad beer. It's also a tasty beer, but I prefer the oak. I think it has more interesting character notes, and I think it's kind of more complex. And
unlike a lot of barrel-aged beers that I've had, it doesn't knock me down with the barrel. I mean, sometimes I just get worn out when somebody says, here's my barrel-aged something. I want to hide. but this is a really good beer.
Smack you in the face with a piece of wood.
Yeah.
And this is an interesting thing about time, because I think the overall complexity has dropped a bit on the unoaked beer. And I never got, I think, the perfect yeast profile for either one. I had temperature control, but I think maybe I should have pushed it a bit higher, something like that. Would have liked a little more fermentation character. It's good, but I just really like to push it a bit further. But I just put my two of them together, and I like that. I think it's fun.
I agree. The blended version is very nice, too.
Well, here we go.
I drank both of mine. I'm going to have to re-pour.
And I think over time, because we did initially, it nice. Really required the blend. It really was important. The oaked was interesting, but you didn't want to finish the glass. But when you mixed it with the unoaked, then you had something that was really enjoyable. And now, several years later, that ratio has changed. And blending them now tastes very good, but I think the oaked actually probably wins.
Together, it's a different experience. It's I like that as well.
Me too. I think it's delicious. Which is we've talked about this before, how blending can really help you a lot, and you know, take a beer that's kind of average and turn it into something that's something really exciting.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. It's it's a blend. It's it's blending the good characteristics of both.
And I think the real thing that I bottled them separately. I didn't need to blend them beforehand. And then I can just open two bottles, and if I'm sharing with some folks, we can make a blend. Or as I said, stick them in a keg. But just play with it and go, okay, do I want 50-50, 70-30? And just do it in your glass and have fun. And that's one thing, actually, with basic brewing, I've seen you guys just, okay, let's add these together. Oh, hey, that's great. Let's do more of that.
And it's an advantage to, if you were to blend this in the beginning, you would have less control than you do now.
In the beginning, I wanted 70-30 unoaked to oaked. Now I might go the other direction.
Yeah, very nice. Do we have any more surprises in the mystery box?
One last one. And this is actually the one I'm most excited about and was kind of part of the point of the project. So this is a sour beer. And I figured after a certain point, we're going to get some contamination and let's just get ahead of it. Instead of doing too many batches, let's go for it.
Taste it like a man. Yeah.
But at the same time also, I was also worried that if I did a sour beer right up front, there'd be way too much whiskey and tannins that would have ruined it. So I need to essentially scrub the barrel to make it ready for sour. So I'd call this somewhere between like a Flanders red and an Old Bruin style. So I was going for some acetic character and a little residual sweetness. I was at least two different commercial blends and dregs from several different bottles. But I did first a clean, let's see here. I started with a clean fermentation. and then added all those blends and dregs as it was going into the barrel.
So it's a suicide.
And it was in the barrel for 2.5 years.
Wow. Yeah.
So we bottled it this past Christmas. Yeah, so it's been there for so long. And we'd take samples, pull out the nail every about 6 months. And for the first year, we're just like, this is bland. This is boring. I hope this goes somewhere. There was no tartness to it. It picked up a teeny bit of maybe Brett thing, but only in an off way. But it was just amazingly mild. And then finally, after 2 years, I'm like, oh, we're getting somewhere. And so we planned when I came to visit for Christmas that we'd go ahead and bottle it. And so then once again, you never want the barrel to be empty. So I wrote up, I'm like, okay, this is a simple recipe. We can do a quick extract recipe for the next beer to go in. So I said, okay, Dad, brew this batch. I actually ordered the ingredients online, sent it to him. He brewed it, and it was already fermented, ready to go, so that when we bottled this, which is a big bottling thing to bottle a barrel, we had this one ready to pour right in for the next beer. And this next batch might be disposable. We want to move it from California to Washington via car. And I have no idea what that's going to do to it. It could ruin it completely. So we didn't worry about exactly what beer was in there, but that we need to keep it alive and healthy. And we'll sample it when it gets up to Washington and see if we're going to put in a different beer or keep going with it.
And did you have to top off? Did you have an issue with the Angel Share?
I believe once or twice. So we made sure we had an extra gallon in a jug. And I think we filled it up twice, but only in the first year. It then seemed to stabilize.
Great.
I was reading online, this whole thing, 8-gallon barrel is nothing like a big Fodor, those really big, several hundred gallon tons they're using. And I realized my oxygen was way too high. And so I was asking around online looking, and someone recommended coat it in paraffin. So we melted block of paraffin from the grocery store and coated the barrel in wax to reduce the oxygen uptake. And I don't know, maybe it worked, maybe it didn't, but it didn't hurt.
Did you see a lessening of the Angel Share, the losing?
Yes, we had to top it off a couple times in the first year, and we didn't subsequently have to top it off. So
wow.
The Angel Share definitely went down.
Approximately how, I guess I didn't hear, how long before did you go before you put the wax on it? Did you go a year, did 2 years?
A few months.
Okay, so it was pretty early.
Yeah, we're seeing it go down in volume. With the paraffin on, it reduced it. I also think just it moved, because we put the paraffin on it while still in my garage in Belmont, California, which is a bit warmer. Then moved to his dirt basement in Pacifica, which is moist and cool. And that also must have reduced the Angel Share as well. So we didn't isolate the location and the paraffin.
Have you heard of doing that anywhere else? Or
On Homebrew Talk, I was digging around and I was looking at... I'm trying to remember who it was, but there's actually... I can try and go look it up. There's a guy who's been playing around with the size of barrels and the concerns of overoxidization. And he did a ratio calculation. And he's like, this is... An 8-gallon barrel is like 10 times more oxygen than a 50-gallon barrel. And it's another almost 10 times as much as a big... one of those big Fodors that they have in Belgium.
So, but coating it in paraffin.
Yeah.
Did you just come up with that, or...?
I'm not sure whether someone suggested it. I'm not sure if they actually suggested it based on experience. It was just, okay, let's try and reduce this.
Interesting. I just wanted to give you credit if it was your idea. But.
Problems all happened a while ago, and I took notes on the recipes, but not on all the processes, which in retrospect was maybe a mistake.
Ooh.
Relax. Have a homebrew.
Yeah, that's right. We should just have Charlie come over and say that. Oh, woo, it smells good.
Yeah, it does.
Well, it's got my salivary glands are going there.
Yeah, nice bready nose to it.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, that's really nice. Reminds me a lot, quite a bit of La Follette.
Yeah.
You say that of all sour beers, don't you?
it's not as sauerkrauty on the nose as Lafaly is, I don't think, but it's very nice. I think it may be a little more drinkable than Lafaly, because Lafaly's, or at least in the past, Lafaly has been fairly aggressive.
And also, this has a lot of time on it, so it also is about, well, it's Christmas, so about 6 months in the bottle, good amount of time in that barrel. I think it definitely helps with all that time, but it also needed the time to develop. Particularly, I like the bit of the vinegary character. I'm trying to remember, what's the classic Flanders Red? I'm just blanking for a moment. Rodenbach. Yeah, so I was kind of aiming from some Rodenbach here. And there is that vinegar character that for some other sours isn't appropriate, but I definitely wanted that.
Yeah, for some reason this week, my capacity for remembering names has been diminished, so...
Nothing to do with all the beer you're drinking.
Pshaw. No, this is very drinkable. And would go well with food as well. But, you know, this is a sour that it is very nicely tart. But I can see drinking a glass of this by itself.
Oh yeah. Yeah, we've gotten to try a lot of sour beers here this weekend, and some of them have been intensely sour to the point that I didn't feel I could drink a whole glass of it. They're delicious for sure and super complex, but this is nice and would be great with food, and I could drink a whole pint of it.
Easily drink a pint of this, easily.
Now, do we get any of the wood character in this?
Probably that's part of the complexity of it in the background, but I'm not pulling out those strong like coconut or vanilla or any of those things that you typically get from the more fresh oak.
I agree. Steve's nodding.
I'm so happy. This is the first sour beer I've done.
Oh, wow.
So for it to turn out this well, I'm really happy, because this was a big experiment and gamble, that amount of time invested in the barrel. I did my best research I could, but... I knew it could have just gone not worked. And I'm so happy that it turned out as well as it did.
It was all the caretaking, right, Kurt?
Yeah, well, I had to keep checking on it down in the basement. But I think the...
it was a Kurt's share. That's what...
Instead of an angel share. But I think this is an example. The barrel is not just about adding flavor or oak or vanilla and all that kind of flavor things. It is a vessel... You know, if this was in a carboy for 2 years, we would not see this same transformation. So it's the fact that wood is a way to age something, not so much about adding flavor. You know, so the rye is gone, the oak, the char, all that. It's all about what, you know, time in wood.
And to make all those little organisms happy, and now they're permanently embedded in that thing. There's no going back. And so we'll see how many years I can keep this thing going. I've heard that the next batch should go a good bit faster because they're really well set up. And so we'll see how long it takes to make a beer of a similar sourness. I'm expecting it will be nowhere near 2.5 years.
There's certainly a bunch of nooks and crannies for them to hide in. So,
yeah, I'm expecting you're going to produce several more batches of delicious sour beer, my friend.
I hope so.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, and it's a privilege to have been able to sample them. And I think it's so cool that you guys are working so closely together on this project, and it's one of the benefits of home brewing that, I guess it appears that it's kept you guys closer together.
Oh, yeah. It was one of the major downsides moving up to Seattle as I'm moving farther away from my dad and brew partner. And so I'm inviting friends over up in Seattle, but they're not nearly as reliable and helpful as he is. But this is great because, so I just graduated with my MBA on Monday. And
congratulations.
From University of Washington. And this is kind of my post-graduation celebration.
Go so, Huskies.
Yeah, exactly. Go Huskies. And so I flew down, he drove down, and we met up over beer. And this is my second NHC, and this is his first.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing, and it was great to spend some
Absolutely.
Time with you.
Congratulations.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for having me on here, and I think at this point we need to track down our wives and have some lunch.
Yeah, but this is fabulous, and as you can tell, I'm extremely proud of Nick, and I think this shows, you know, homebrewing is a great, you know, father-son or family affair, and my part is to support, you know, and it's been great.
And,
you
guys and drink some great beer occasionally, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Makes great for the Christmas party.
Excellent.
Cheers, guys.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again to Nick and Kurt Keast and to Steve Wilkes and, of course, to Andy Sparks of thehomebrewery.com, my local homebrew shop. What a fun time with some really tasty beers. And as my own son prepares to attend the University of Washington up there in Seattle, it was good to hear that they're staying close, even if they're further or farther apart from each other. My son's not old enough to drink beer or you know, use homebrewing as a basis. But we got other things going on, and I'm sure that I wouldn't be surprised if we're more in touch the way electronics go nowadays when he heads away. I got something in my eye here. Let me... if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. And for a limited time, you can get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. And check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that purchased through the link are RFID Blocking Men's Leather Classic Bifold Wallet Black, Stops Electronic Pickpocketing, Works Against Identity Theft and Credit Card Data Breach. There you go. And also from Amazon, small barrels produce lousy whiskey. Well, I can tell you they produce good beer, so I don't know about the quality of whiskey. But man, the beer is good coming out of them. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate link on basicbrewing.com as well. But what you should do until the end of this month is go to homebrewersassociation.org, click join, and use the offer code BBR at checkout to get that free book of designing great beers. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.